I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hei folkens, mitt navn Bengt Are Barstad. Jeg har et turprosjekt som heter For 1000 dager ute. Akkurat nå så sitter jeg I Dividalen I Indre Troms og har vært på tur sammenhengende I 710 dager. Utstyret jeg har med på en sånn tur utrolig viktig for at turen både trygg og behagelig. Og akkurat nå så har teltet mitt fra Barents Outdoor stått fjellstøtt gjennom en av de verste vinterstormene jeg faktisk har vært gjennom på turen så langt. I tillegg så har Barents Outdoor en fantastisk serviceavdeling som hjelper meg med reparasjoner av resten av utstyret mitt også. Og det kommer utrolig godt med, for jeg har ikke tenkt å stoppe etter 1000 dager. Så alle dere som mye på tur, trenger service og bra utstyr, gå inn på barentsoutdoor.no. Det utrolig bra utstyr de lager I dag altså.
Hei, og velkommen til podcasten Uteliv. Mitt navn Randolf Valle. To those of you that don't understand Norwegian, please be patient for a minute while I explain my regular listeners why today's episode is in English. Gjennom de drøyt 100 episoderne jeg har lagd siden jeg startet podcasten Uteliv, så har jeg egentlig aldri vurdert gjester som ikke snakker norsk. Men da tilbudet om å prate med klatrelegenden Konrad Anker dukket opp, så tenkte jeg at det var dumt å bare avfeie det. Jeg endte med å ta turen til Oslo for å møte den, og personlig synes jeg det ble en svært interessant prat. Hovedmengden av gjestene I podcasten Uteliv vil alltid være norskspråklig, men jeg ser ikke bort fra at det kan bli aktuelt med en og annen engelskspråklig episode også I fremtiden. Det det til sjuende og sist dere lyttere som bestemmer. Jeg tar gjerne imot tilbakemeldinger på hvordan dere synes det her fungerer, men gi det en ærlig sjanse.
Well, so then I switch to English, because today's guest is Konrad Anker, and it's an honor to have you here in Podcast Uteliv today.
Well, thank you, Randolph, and thank you, listeners, for listening to my English. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a conversation, because my Norwegian is quite limited.
Okay. You have been a professional climber since the 1990s, and you have been the leader of the North Face Expedition team for more than 25 years. And you have a long list of notable ascents in areas like Alaska, Antarctica, Himalayas, and you summited Mount Everest 3 times. It's a whole lot of adventure.
Yeah.
But you're also one of those climbers whose reputation has reached sort of outside the climbing community. And that's, of course, partly due to your climbs that have been featured in magazines like National Geographic and Outside. It's partly also because you found Mallory on Everest 75 years after he disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah. So welcome, listeners. I'm Conrad Anker. I'm from Bozeman, Montana. I'm on today's date. I'm 59 years old. Honored to be a guest here with Randolph. And I enjoy climbing for what it is, a chance to get out and explore and see things. And you touched briefly on the May 1st, 1999, which was the date that I discovered the frozen and well-preserved body of George Lee Mallory, who had disappeared some 75 years earlier on the 8th of June, 1924, along with his climbing partner, Sandy Irvin, when they were trying to be the first climbers to make it to the summit of Mount Everest. And that moment, that inflection point, really changed who I was and my background as a climber.
Mm-hmm. And also, you will be known because you're a husband, you're a father of three sons, and also your life story sort of embodies those large philosophical questions that tend to be connected to climbing, with risk and with the reward you get for the risk, but also with loss and consequences, both for you and the people surrounding you.
Yeah, certainly. And climbing is a dangerous sport. And when you try to rationalize it and say, oh, life is risky wherever it is or whatever we do, you're kind of avoiding that what you really need to know about. And because climbing is dangerous. And because of that, we have to accept the value proposition that an intrinsic reward that we get from being outdoors with our friends and kind of putting ourselves through hardship by our own volition is worth the potential downside, which is loss of life, and we are extinguished, but the pain that is left behind with the people that we love is really something that weighs upon all of us as climbers.
Mm. I think these things here are what we'll spend the next hour talking about. But before we start on that, have you had any like enriching and rewarding outdoors or nature experiences now lately?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'm a guest here in Norway, thanks to the North Face and Petzl equipment. And I've spent a week at the Arctic Ice Festival up by Narvik and had a great time climbing. We had people there and then had some personal climbing days. So we were in the Bardu Valley. Friday climbed the Skredbekken, which is a 700-meter ice climb. Had a wonderful day out and started early in the morning and got back after the sun had set and got cold. And it was full of adventure. And those moments are, we do those to create memories. And those memories are, those are what we have with us.
Mm-hmm. But you live in Montana in the United States?
That's correct, in Montana, in Bozeman, Montana, southwest. So we're just outside of Yellowstone National Park, home to Montana State University. Great community. I'm there with my wife, Jennifer, and our three sons, Max, Sam, and Isaac.
Mm. It's not the worst place to live when you're sort of into outdoors and climbing. And
yeah. Well, people are like, are there mountains in Montana? And I'm, well, in Spanish, montaña means mountain. Mm-hmm. So, the Spanish roots of the thing was mountains. So we have the spine of the Rockies runs through our state. The eastern part is the plains. It's traditional lands of many different Native American communities to recognize them and to be part of it. But it's also, for me, as someone that loves the mountains and has spent a life climbing and then being professional, and it's a great place to be.
Mm-hmm. But when you get back from, let's say, a 2 month expedition in a remote area and you get back home, do you want to get out in your local nature, or would you rather go for a cup of coffee?
First thing when I get home is I see the family. They come to the airport and they meet me, which is always wonderful. Every expedition is a circle from when you leave your garden gate to when you make it to the summit, down safely, and then when you walk in the garden gate again. And so we have the front door of the house, but we always have the garden gate that's where you live in. And that's so when I pass through that threshold of the garden gate, it is a successful thing. But the first thing is cooking a meal with the family, spending time after being in a travel, taking a sauna, cleaning out. And then, if I can spend 3 days, a portion of those 3 days each week outdoors, it's good for my mental well-being and good for a sense of adventure. And we live on this planet, after all, for what brings us joy. And we work to create that joy. And being fortunate that we have the wherewithal, you and I, white males of European descent, the system benefits us. And to recognize that is sort of the first step in it. But so, yeah, very fortunate to live where we do. Mm.
But when you look back at things, what made you sort of embrace the outdoors at first?
I was a little backstory family. My mother, who has passed away, and my father, who has passed away. My mother was from Torgau, a small town outside of Dresden, East Germany. And so she was born in 1933 and saw the ravages of war and Soviet occupation and all of that. Met my father, who was in the United States service after the war, and they fell in love. And then he brought her to California, where my father's side of the family is from. So my maternal grandmother is Scotch-Irish, Corcoran, and then my paternal grandparents, Anker, were from Denmark, and they came to Ukiah, which is on the north coast of California, as shipwrights, and then they met. And they were born in 1903. My father was born in 1928, and then I was born in 1962. And throughout all of this, where my father's side of the family was in the Sierra Nevada mountains of California, so land that was traditionally Miwok Indian land. They were provisioners to gold miners, so they had beans and wheat for the gold miners, but not gold miners themselves. And but we always, every summer, we would head into the high country between Sonora Pass and Tioga Pass, two passes over the Sierras, and we'd go north to south or south to north, sort of alternating each year with mules and sort of in the backcountry. And that was the foundation of it. And then at age 14, sort of learned the ropes of climbing. Age 16, went to Mount Rainier to climb that with glaciers and things like that, and sort of kept progressing with that. Age 23, driving a Ford Econoline van from Utah, where I was attending university, out to Alaska to climb the Kachatna Spires. So I was I realized early that I was a lifer, and it was good that I stuck with it.
Yeah. Just grab my glasses.
Is the sound coming across well?
Yeah, it's good.
So I enjoy this art form, and I really appreciate it. Yeah, and I listen to podcasts on a regular basis. And so kind of on a tangent here, my work is communicative. And so when I'm on a computer, I'm talking to someone, I can't engage my mind in something else. But for every 8 hours of standing around and working on a computer and shuffling pixels and in Zoom meetings, I spend a half hour of working with wood, and I listen to a podcast, and it's so regenerative to me. So I really enjoy that. And thank you to all the podcasters out there for bringing us the news of the world.
Oh, thanks. And I say thanks on behalf of the podcasters of the world.
Yeah. Thank you, Randolph.
Yeah. But have you ever sort of reflected of why you became a climber? I mean, people become fly fishers, nature photographers, whatever. So why was that your direction into it?
I was introduced to it at a young age by my father. mother and a lot of my father's friends, and we'd get out in the backcountry and we'd go do things. And there was this, like, when I climbed a 5'6", which isn't too difficult. I mean, the handholds are generous and the footholds are obvious. There was this moment I was like, this is it. Like, I had plugged into the meaning of life. My life socket found its setting, and I was like, I'm going to pursue this. And part of that is when I get outdoors and I stand above the ground and my mental focus shifts from thinking about the drilling in the background and all the noise and all this input to self-preservation. Because if I make a mistake, I'm going to hurt myself. And that moment that brings me to that is very, very special.
So the risk is sort of a part of what makes climbing rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. A good look at that. And we get three body lengths above the ground and all of a sudden self-preservation. So the very ancient part of our brain, the part that tells us to breathe and to, you know, it's autonomic. We don't think about it. And up here in the front of our brain, we're like, well, if I take the bus, it'll be this amount of time. The taxi's that. You're kind of rationalizing things and you process things that way. But when you have a way to communicate to the ancient part of your brain in this society, that's pretty cool.
Mm. But before we move on with the climbing, I listened to a radio program you took part in on BBC.
Oh, called, yeah.
The Desert Island Discs.
Yeah.
Where you, it's a radio show that has been aired since 1942, I think.
Yeah.
And the guest is allowed to pick 8 records that you would bring to a remote island. But you were also allowed to bring one book.
Yeah.
You remember which you choose?
Ooh, yeah. And so Desert Island Disc is sort of the original podcast. And it was Christy Young, I think was her name. I felt honored that I had that opportunity. It was 2013. So we're... please remind me, what was the book that I...
It was The Complete Works of Jack London.
Oh!
is that also sort of a childhood memory, or is it sort of a more recent discovery?
No, Jack London, yeah, thank you. Yeah, Jack London was a writer at the turn of the century, and he was a fictional writer. So, of course, sort of the high society didn't look into it too favorably. But those stories of, like, To Build a Fire or Daylight Burning or all these other Never Cry Wolf, these epic stories, as a young boy, that was like, that's what I read. And they just were there. And, I mean, there's certainly revisionist historians that we look at Jack London through the prism of today's society, and he wasn't perfect. And the same thing with John Muir, and we have to understand that. But the cultural implications aside, those adventures and everything really brought a sense of something to go do with it. And I just, it was, yeah, I'd still, a good Jack London read is...
But do you think that that what drove people to go to the Klondike Gold Rush, is there any similarities between their driving forces and what makes people go climbing in remote areas of the world today?
Yeah. Seeking gold is, I mean, there's financial reward to it and there's something that you get from it. But having grown up in the 49er country, which is gold rush country, and our family settled there in 1853, and there's still people that love to go panning for gold. And I remember working construction and it would rain and the boss would be like, well, Ed's not going to show up for work today because he's panning for gold. Mm-hmm. And they love to go do that. So if the drive for the Klondike Gold Rush was an intrinsic or if it was material, I don't know. But that same fascination with something and that trying to answer the unknown is common to all pursuits.
Hmm. Yeah. But during the 1990s, climbing turned into a profession for you. Can you tell a little bit about that process? Because there wasn't many professional climbers in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, and particularly in the United States. And Europe has more of a history of climbing, and so an adventure. And so we think of Amundsen in the South Pole. He was a professional at what he did. He planned for it. He sought sponsors, and he had to bring something back in return. And I started working for the North Face in 1983. 1987, I would get a mountain jacket and a sleeping bag and went to Alaska, and then 88, went to the Himalayas. And you do these journeys, and you bring something back within it. And so in this 39-year relationship with the brand, it's been great to encourage people to get outdoors and try something. So in that sense, bring something to it. But it's quite different than professional sports, where we have rules, we set a spatial restraint, we put a clock on it, and then we pit humans against humans. And someone is going to lose. One team is the victor, the other team is the loser. And that sort of team sport thing didn't work for me. So I was a little bit of an odd duck in school. I had a funny name. And then when I went and played American football, where they hit each other, and it's kind of intense. And those guys were like, oh, we're just going to take it out on him. I felt even worse. But there was a scoutmaster, so in Boy Scouts and getting outdoors and things like that, who took us out. And we did things like winter camping and fishing and, you know, making a little, you know, arts and crafts and things like that. And that was really where I found my community in that sense. And in a way, non-confrontational, supportive ways of being humans. So having been on the receiving end of people's aggression, I didn't want to put that on other people. I wanted to find ways that made them feel good, because people that did that for me were the people I looked up to. Mm.
So like an expedition feels better because you're a team working against the goal, not against another team.
100%. So Randolph, if you and I go climbing and we rope up and we put each other on belay, our lives are literally in each other's hands. And you don't get that in tennis. I mean, it's a great sport and I love it. And I mean, my goal on tennis is how many times can we hit the ball back and forth and just enjoying the moment and the sound of the ball on the racket. But it's still competitive. It's still pitting one human against another. And I think now where we are with society, with 7.4 billion people, we need to shift that paradigm so we're more open to understanding that we need to collaborate and we need to work together to create a better and more just, equitable society. And if we find a sport or recreation that does that, then that's helping collectively further that goal.
Okay, that's interesting. During the 90s, that's a sort of you were featured in National Geographic, Outside Magazine, and I believe sort of the financial funding for your expeditions was growing. But did your sponsor in any way sort of have their say on what projects the North Face expedition team would do?
All the expeditions, and still to this day, are ideas that the athletes bring. And so a lot of them, there've been no success. I mean, you don't make it to the summit, you don't finish the running race that you're after, things like that. And so they've always been very open to that. And knowing that the relationship that we have is that we are storytellers. What we do is experiential. It's not who runs the fastest 100 meters. There you know who the winner is. Mm-hmm. But we have to be storytellers. So we think back to time immemorial. We've always had those that have left the comfort of their community to go out and try something unknown. And the archetypical story of that is the Odyssey by Homer, where they went out and they come back. And so in that sense, there was always a good, that relationship that having with the brand and being able to bring back stories and or create stories has been good. So it's unique in that sense. And so I guess in a way we could have we were like the influencers became influencers, but we actually did something rather than holding up the toothpaste and smiling.
Yeah, that's true. But also, when I look at your expedition list, there are many really, really remote locations. You have Alaska, you have Baffin Island, you have the Himalayas, you have Antarctica. Is sort of the remoteness something that attracts you by itself, or is it just a search for something that's unseen or unclimbed?
Humans have always wanted to explore. So we would cross the oceans, we'd climb the mountains to see what was on the other side. And so there's innate part of humanity is to explore. And obviously now we both have these wonderful handheld computers, and you can look on there and you can be like, oh, that's what Greenland looks like. But if you didn't know what it was there, there was, and I think that passion for exploration, that gene might be part of some people's DNA build out or something like that. And so they're the ones that are going to want to be going out and seeing the world and traveling. And that, and it's, I have three siblings and not, you know, they know what I do and they go camping, but they're not like hardwired to go out to the very remote wild places. And for me to stand on the top of a cliff and to not to see any human for around there, it's a reminder of how small we are and how fragile our planet is. And not to see it as like I'm a conquistador or I conquered it or, you know, I dominated it. Rather, it's like I'm here by the blessings of good weather and sort of understanding it in that sense.
Yeah, and also, of course, Antarctica is there's no people there, but even when you go to the most remote areas in Arctic Canada or the Himalayas or Alaska, there are people there who's been there for a very, very long time.
Yeah, excepting Antarctica, every kilometer on this planet has had human beings have been there. And that's, I think we kind of lose sight of that in today's, like, well, people hadn't been there, but I'm like, 400,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, 10,000, 2,000 years ago, people were traveling, and their knowledge and what they were good at, we always tend to be like, oh, in the Stone Age, they just weren't smart because they didn't have a calculator. I didn't understand the stars, but they knew how to live in ways that we don't know now. I mean, there's only a few people that would still have those skills. But that knowledge has been the foundation of all of humanity to get us to where we are today. Hmm. I don't know if that's abstract or makes sense.
I think that makes sense. My experience is primarily with the Inuit of Arctic Canada and sort of that culture who has sort of been able to live in an environment without wood and not only survive, but live relatively well. I think that never stops to impress me.
Yeah, Inuit, and then also people from the Amazon and Native American. And yeah, it's just it's a wonderful world that we live in. And it never ceases me to the understanding and the knowledge of it.
Mm. But then, as we touched into in the beginning here, 1999 was a year that really changed your life.
Yeah.
First in the spring, it was the Everest expedition for where you found the remains of Mallory. How did you get into that expedition?
So, 1999, the Mallory and Irvine Research Expedition. I was invited along by Dave Hahn and Eric Simonson, as my goal was to be the backup for, if the body wasn't located, to have a go at the second step to see what the climbing would entail on that. And it was just by chance that on the 1st of May, I came upon the frozen corpse of George Mallory, a very humbling moment for me. And then the news went around the world. Some people thought it was interesting. Other people decried it and didn't think it was the right thing. And then a few months later, on the 5th of October, I lost my best friend Alex Lowe and David Bridges, our climbing partner, the three of us were walking across a glacier on Shishapangma when an avalanche released and took the two of their lives. So it was, 99 was a pretty big, heavy year. And then I guess another heavy year was 2016 for me. So that was when I had a heart attack, and the same year that the bodies of Alex and David were released from the glacier. So we traveled to Tibet to attend to them.
Yeah. I'm not sure all the listeners know sort of the rest of your family history, because after Alex Lowe died, you sort of took care of his sons.
Yeah. So Jenny and I were close. I was there. That was, and we grew to love each other. And so the first, we're being together, and the 6th of April, 2001, we were married. And I stepped in for Alex and raised the boys and was there as part of the family, and was the most meaningful thing in my life.
Hmm. It's a very emotional story, which is now covered in a film that your son is the director for, Torn, which
yes.
is just out.
Yeah.
It's available on Disney Plus, and it's well worth an evening.
Yeah, thank you. It's an emotional, vulnerable film. It's one that it's our story told by us rather than our story told by a production company or someone that might want to interpret the story through their own prism. So having Max, our eldest son, turn the camera on himself and our family to share that is definitely it's definitely meaningful.
Yeah. But also, it must have been painful.
Yeah.
And it must have been sort of a huge personal cost to go through that process. What was your reaction when Max told you what he intended to do?
Yeah, well, we traveled to Nepal in late June, early July 2016, and we attended to the bodies. We performed a cremation of David and Alex, and David's family were with us. And at that point, we kind of realized that maybe that Max would like to tell that story. And I've been supportive of him. Jenny's been supportive of him. We've done collectively, we've worked together on that. But for myself, it was a process. You and I are probably similar in age, and we kind of keep things close. We don't necessarily need to share everything with everyone, and there's the too much information overload that we get, particularly with social media and the barrage of information that we're constantly assaulted with. And here, to strip away all of that, to talk honestly about loss, love, reconciliation, acceptance, our own mortality, and to do it as a family was a lot of work, but in a way, it was something that we and myself in particular had to give back to the community, because we see the narrative of people climbing on mountains and they've made it to the top and it's this great success story and everything is wonderful. But the downside of this is that people die. And for you and I, if we die tomorrow, it's like the light bulb pops and we return to dust. But for the people that are left behind, they're the ones that go through the emotional grief of loss. And so by accepting that, recognizing that, and giving people space and permission to talk about it is pretty meaningful.
Mm. Yes, because I also watched another film you're featured in during the last week in preparation to this. from the expedition to the Meru shark fin.
Yeah.
And when I've seen both those movies, I think in a way they deal with the same topic, but from two different perspectives. That the film from Meru is sort of a description of the pure dedication and what it takes to do a climb like that, and what you're sort of willing to sacrifice in order to reach that summit. While Thorn is a film of the implication that drive and that focus have on the people that surround you.
Very good observation, very good. And thank you to Renan, Jimmy, Chai, Bob, everyone that helped make Meru the film it was. And in the third act of Meru, we talk about loss with Alex and that what I have to go through that. And so the two films, they complement each other, they bookend them. But as you noticed, like, what is that cost that we actually pay when people disappear or are lost?
Hmm. But if we stick with Meru for a while, that's a peak that seems to have become sort of an obsession for you.
that's fair to say.
Yeah. It's called the shark fin. It looks like a shark fin. It's not even the highest point of that mountain.
But it's the most aesthetic, right? Yeah. So even if you're a non-climber, you can look at that and say, like, earth sciences and the forces of geology and gravity and glaciers and weathering created a masterpiece of this blade of granite that drew us to it. And for me, my mentor when I was young, Mug Stump, who was 14 years older than I am, had sought to climb that peak, and he'd tried it two times and then perished in 1992 in a crevasse fall. And that lodestone, that motivation that he had, transferred on to me, and it was my responsibility, my choosing to carry it on, and then to do it in the same way by helping and mentoring others.
Mm-hmm. I can say that film is available on iTunes. It's well worth the watch as well. But just to give people an impression of you had brought food for a week, but you stayed there for like 3 weeks?
2008, we ended up being up there for a long time. But
you were eating dinner, and that was one like matchbox-sized piece of cheese grilled on the propane stove.
Yeah.
You traveled around the globe, and you're within like 100 meters of the summit, and you've gone all through all this, and then you turn. What does it take to make that decision?
Yeah, when we turned back in 2008, it was the right decision. We were almost at the summit, things were starting to add up. I dropped an ice axe. We'd lost a pair of gloves. Those things kind of build up. And so as the saying goes, you keep adding a straw to the camel's back, and the camel can't carry it anymore, and then the camel collapses. And what was the straw that broke the camel's back? And how I look at a climb, one is to do it safely, two is to come back as friends, and three is to make the summit. And so when that's your decision-making prism, it's very obvious what it is. And that was, but they're,
But nevertheless, when Jimmy Chin came back, he was rolled out of the plane in a wheelchair and he couldn't walk for like 6 or 7 weeks, if I remember correct.
Yeah, people, we were at wit's end, so to say.
Yeah, and between that expedition and the final expedition where we actually summited, both your climbing partners were in really serious mountain accidents.
Yeah.
What makes you go back? Because it seemed like Meru's shark fin is sort of a risk level that's a tiny bit about a few other things.
Yeah, it's dangerous. This is an ice slope to get to it, and then alpine climbing, and then a big wall, and then more ice, and then another rock. I mean, everything is combined to make it difficult. And it was a sought-after peak. Many expeditions had tried it. And if I could answer that question, mm-hmm. and I knew the answer, it'd probably give me a better night's rest, because times I wake up and I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Why am I doing this? But then again, if you knew the answer, it wouldn't be your goal.
No. But when you do a risk assessment, do you try to sort of break it down into pieces that you can sort of account for? Or is it more sort of a emotional, intuitive approach?
For a peak like Meru or many of the other ones, you're motivated to go do it. So you have this energy. You have to wake up and want to go to that peak. And then we're, as climbers, we're always good at rationalizing the risk. We use the front part of our brain, like, well, if I have a good portal edge and a warm sleeping bag and I carry enough fuel and I have this size of climbing equipment, and then we'll be able to get to the summit. But there's this, when the outcome is unknown, that makes the intrinsic reward of achieving that outcome ever more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow me on that.
Yeah, I do partly, but I remember on Meru, it was a part of the mountain you call the deck of cards or the card house.
Yeah.
Which is a portion of the mountain where the front of the wall consists of rock plates that are quite thin and not very well attached to the rest of the mountain.
Yeah.
And I can still remember my back freezing when you heard this hollow sound while you were knocking on it.
Yeah.
Is it really possible to do a real risk evaluation before you start climbing that part? Or is it, how can you sort of calculate the risk for those rocks to come down when you start climbing on them?
You'll do the best you can, but there's always the unknown. And so the way to mitigate that risk is the amount of experience you have going into it. So when we got to Meru, I'd had 30 years of climbing experience. And so I'd seen loose rock, I'd understood it. And so you try to kind of understand where it is, but then you get up there and it's just there. You just don't know. And all mountains are a result of plate tectonics, of mm-hmm. Earth moving around and being thrust up into the mountains and glaciology and things like that. And we all know that all mountains turn into the sea, and so they're in a constant state of transition. And when you get there, you can accelerate that transition, or an earthquake can, or a freeze-thaw cycle. But when you're in the middle of that, then it's quite a challenge.
Yeah.
But the metaphor that I see Meru was that we're much like sailors. When you imagine the sailors when they left from Norway to go on these expeditions, and they would sail in their boats, and they were in the ocean. And so if you fall overboard, you're going to perish. If you don't have water, you'll die of thirst. If you don't have food, you won't be able to, and you didn't know where you're going. But we are sailors in a sea of gravity. So instead of being the cold ocean that's our constant threat, it's the ever-present, always strong force of gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But you said Meru's shark fin, you know, it's beautiful. But while you're up there, do you sort of have the energy to take in the scenery, or is it sort of just staying alive and focus on the climb?
When you're on the sharp end of the rope leading, it's the next meter or two ahead of you, and you're analyzing the rock. Is it loose? What type of gear do I have? And you have one ear to the weather, and you sense the wind with your nose and your face. But then when you take a moment, when you're at the belay or you're in the ledge at night, and you just sort of look over to your partner. And I remember, like, with Renan and Jimmy pinching ourselves, like, wow, can you actually believe that we're here? That look at this, we're out. There's Shivling, and there's the Gangotri Glacier, and there's Tapovan, and like no one else had ever been there on that place on our planet. And that moment to like a realization, that memory is still with me today. And you can see the smile I have just sharing it with you is something that I've brought back with me. And those memories and emotions are why we go outdoors. And those are the memories that we want to create.
Mm-hmm. I think both your climbing partners on that trip are artists, or one photographer, one painter.
Yeah.
Your wife is also a painter. Does that influence the way you look at nature?
Yeah, it's interesting. Why do I gravitate to artists? And you know, because we're interpreting the world through our own idea. When I love science and engineering and everything like that, but it's a different. They complement each other, but. This is a very good question. And this is the first time someone had asked me that connection to artistry. And in a way, what we always talk about as climbing is that the mountain is a blank canvas, and the line that we choose to climb is our form of performance art and how we do it, and then write about it, take pictures, or in best case scenarios, build a film from it.
Mm-hmm. But when you're on an expedition like that and you're going to make a film, that also means you have to film when you least want it. How does that influence the being there? Can it sort of that take away your focus from being at the present?
As we were climbing as a team of three, and that's a safety consideration, so you're safer with three. If one person is injured, you have two to get help bring that person down. When you go two people, it's a higher commitment factor. So that was one of the agreements that with Jenny, that if I am going to go back in the mountains, that I climb in a safe group, something like that. And then with that being, and Jimmy and Renan being wonderful filmmakers and camera people, that they would break out the camera at sunset, or they would like, oh, that was, you know, something's going to happen here. I need to film that. Let's see what it's like. Mm. So all those moments really play into it.
Mm. But also when they were injured between the two expeditions, you bring the camera into very private situations.
Yeah.
Where Renan is at hospital and you're not even sure if he'll ever walk again.
Yeah.
Is that something you agree on when you go into the project, or that you'll sort of bring the camera into those situations?
Yeah, we are storytellers, and the way you're going to tell that story in this day and age is documenting it on film, whether it's an iPhone or a Red or some other, you know, big snazzy camera, you're going to do that. And we accept that as professional climbers, that we need to document one, so for veracity, that you did make it to the top. And so what you said you did stands up to the test of time. And then also, as we were talking about, coming back and sharing that story. And that's whether it's ego-driven or you're doing it just for the sake of art is an individual question.
Mm. But when your son Max now started on Thorn, what were your thoughts on sort of leaving a large part of your life sort of in his hands? What is it like when you wait for the final result? Because you know what you have said.
Yeah.
But you know, don't know how it's going to come together.
Yeah, and a tremendous amount of love and thankfulness and adoration for Max, who made the film, and his film partner Chris Murphy. That the two of them working on the film. And for me, I'm vulnerable. It's my brash youth, as I was a young punk full of ego, and I got to do the hardest thing. And then just to see myself in those moments where I can just, the transition had happened, and to film archive material that had never been, it always, a lot of it just sat in a shoebox in the basement. And then like we're making this film and we're going through these archives and videos of Alex with the boys, videos of in the immediate aftermath of calling Jennifer with the news that Alex had died, and seeing the physical pain, but then also the sorrow that was within my eyes. And yeah, it took quite a bit of strength and bravery for Max to tell that story, but I'm very happy that he did. Hmm.
What, more than anything, was my sort of main impression afterwards? You have a fantastic family.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. With a tremendous amount of love for Jennifer and for...
Yeah, and to hear Jennifer's reflections on it, the way she managed to put words on it, that was... I lack those words in English. I would have to... I hear now that if I was really to sort of communicate what I felt, that would have been easier in Norwegian. But you have a beautiful family.
Well, you're welcome to share that in Norwegian, and your sentiment is most greatly appreciated.
Hmm. But when Alex's body reappeared on Shishapagma, did you ever think of the similarity with you finding Mallory on Everest?
Oh, yeah. There was, and immediately after October 5th, 99, when Alex died, there was, and I kind of internally beat myself up, as the saying might be, because I was like, had I done something, had I crossed the line by disturbing Mallory's body, and had I gone into the supernatural and the unknown, the taboo, and the result of that was losing Alex. And so I've let that go, but there's, if you're going to practice this pursuit, you need to make peace with your own mortality and death. And it's a very high cost to pay for that lesson when you lose people. But when you're in that situation, it's a more relevant understanding of it when compared to movies, which might have gratuitous violence in it many times over. And I can't watch those films because it doesn't, it's just upset. I have to leave, I just can't watch violent movies. And if death is going to happen, that I want to be very clear and present with it and recognize it. And if we think back 200-300 years to people in Norway or Native American communities, indigenous communities around the world, life was very difficult. And when injury and death happened, you were there and you were present. And now we're like, well, the grandparents in the rest home, and eventually one day they're kind of gone. We come bring them some flowers or something like that. But 300 years ago, childbirth was one of the most dangerous moments of a woman's life. And so there was always this expectation of what can happen when that came, when you have the joy of birth and regeneration of life compounded with a cultural history and knowledge that could be that person's end of life.
Hmm.
So being more present with death is me, see my hat.
Hmm.
That's a Jolly Roger skulls and crossbones.
It is. And a year or two ago, I had a guest in the podcast, which is a Norwegian nature photographer, and he had a brain tumor, and he knew he only had months left. But he had sort of always been thinking a lot about the fact that he wouldn't live forever. And he had always thought that what's important in life is those things that are important if you know you're going to die.
Yeah. And I'm 59, and if I get 20 more years to 79 or turn to be 84, I mean, every day is a gift. And so when you realize that 20 years is some 7,000 days, that's not that many. So what are you going to do with those precious days? And well, drink coffee in the morning and then maybe go for a run or enjoy nature, play with animals. But be an agent for good. Be someone that is working to make humanity and the planet we live on a better place for everyone, all sentient beings.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of spending one's days. And I think it was Rick Danko from the band who said that it's not necessarily about changing the world, but about helping the neighborhood.
That is a great, yeah, I'm going to love the band.
During the Everest research expedition, do you think that Mallory and Irvine ever reached the summit? Because that's, I think for a Norwegian to understand what Mallory and Irvine represent, it would be something like if Captain Scott just disappeared on the way to the South Pole and his tent was never found, because you wouldn't have known what happened. And theoretically, he could have been at the pole before Amundsen. And that's a bit of what happened with Mallory and Irvine. They were seen on the way to the summit, and they disappeared.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and they were, it was 8th of June, 1924. Noel O'Dell was the last one to see them, and he was a day behind them in support. And he'd commented that they were moving expeditiously as if to make up for lost time. And then they disappeared into the clouds that are typical of the, as the monsoon approaches and the warm air condenses, and then it clears off at night when it cools down. And yeah, we know unequivocally that it was Tenzing Norgay and Ed Hillary, May 29th, 1953, that made it to the summit of Everest. But could they have done it in 1924? And much as I would like to say, oh yeah, they made it to the top and down, we need to give them credit for what they did and the spirit in which they did it without projecting our own sort of beliefs onto it. And I based this on the fact that they were on the Northeast Ridge, and so they had to confront the first and second steps, and that if particularly the second step, because they weren't out onto the north face of Everest and the Great Couloir, the Norton Couloir, and so we knew that they were on the ridge. They would have had to have climbed that up and down without a rope, and that there was never any evidence from there. So we should celebrate who they are, what they did, what they stood for in the prism of where they were at that time without trying to say, oh, they made it. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm. But how do you think you would have managed on Everest in their equipment?
We tried in 2007 in the Wildest Dream with Atlantic Productions, and we got to 7,000 meters, and we had the same clothing. We had researched it in 7 layers, wool, silk, leather boots, and as long as we were moving, we were doing okay, but as soon as we stopped, we didn't have the benefit of synthetic boots and down insulation and nylon jackets and things that we take for granted. And so it was, but again, you know, they were tougher for it then, but you also acclimate to what you have. And so you kind of get used to it. And whether it's being cold or whether it's being hot, we have a pretty broad range of adaptability and being able to kind of keep our mind going through these temporary hardships.
Hmm. And that's something I believe that for climbers today as well, that to be able to sort of push through the hardships, because it seems like you have a sort of totally different understanding of the word pain.
Yeah, and it's when we've looked at what are the markers for a successful high altitude climber, and working with Dr. Bruce Johnson of the Mayo Clinic and running all these tests. And yeah, certainly lung volume, oxygen perfusion, VO2 max, muscle mass, a lot of those things kind of feed into it. But at the end of the day, it's what you can generate from your mind upstairs. And in that sense, I mean, yeah, we're kind of soft these days. We don't realize how hard it is. When people are like, gosh, you only ate like 3 tablespoons of oatmeal in the morning and a half an energy bar and a little bit of olive oil and a piece of cheese rind for dinner for a week. I'm like, well, yeah, the Inuit would be in famine for a long time when they couldn't hunt anything, and then they would have a lot of food. And so that feast and famine is part of the collective DNA to get us to where we are. And that's why we crave food and we always want to have more of it, because we know that we could run out of it. And then, of course, we've put salt and sugar together, which doesn't really occur in a natural setting, and it drives our taste sensations wild, but it also, it's probably not the healthiest thing too, so.
No, of course, evolutionary, you're always safer having the food on your body because it can't be stolen.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so do you have any like major expeditions plans now, or?
Well, I had a heart attack in 2016, so I kind of realized that I need to give up the 7,000-meter granite spire type climbing, and I was good enough along those lines. And but yeah, there's the travel to Nepal, trips to Antarctica. It's been wonderful being here in Norway. I look forward to coming back again in the winter, and I'd like to see it in the summer and spring and the fall, and just interacting with people. And I think after 2 years of COVID, we kind of realize how wonderful it is to travel. And I mean, yeah, we have the guilt of the amount of carbon we put in the atmosphere of doing it, and we do our best to offset that with trees and the like. But it's still, for me, to wake up in Oslo and to hear the seagulls and the turn of the streetcar wheels on the steel tracks and to walk on the cobblestones. I went and visited the Nobel Peace Museum this morning. I mean, these things that are, you don't get through a television. You have to experience them. And, you know, how was it cold, or where are people going, or having coffee in a cafe and not speaking the language, being a guest there, those are all precious moments.
Yes. I think we are approaching the end there, but I want to return to Jack London. You remember The Call of the Wild?
Yeah.
The dog buck that is stolen from his home and taken to Alaska, I think.
Yeah.
And Buck is sort of torn between his loyalty to his master and to his pack on one side, and his urge to join the wild wolves that he hears howling.
Yeah.
Is that something you can relate to? Is that sort of an allegory of, on one side, wanting to be loyal to your pack, on the other hand, you want to heed the call of the wild?
Thank you. That's a great way of looking at that. And I really appreciate your research into this and knowing that the sort of the story of Jack London. But yeah, part of me, yeah, I need to be here and I need to be part of society and have a credit card with 16 numbers and an expiration date that pays for the coffee and all of this. But other times I'm like, when I was in northern Norway on the top of this mountain, I just like looked out and I was like, wow. What it'd be like if we just were in a tent. And I mean, of course we need the support of society and everything, but that sense of raw power where you feel small and vulnerable because nature is so powerful, that there's a good lesson within that. And perhaps the world leaders that are high on power and full of almighty, that a humbling moment in nature would do them well in how they treat other people.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should round them up and send them on a boot camp.
Yeah, I'm happy to go suffer. So let's go out and run out of food.
Yeah, and like you said previously, that you have to work together, depend on each other, and you're not going to compete. You're going to work against a common goal.
Yeah, and we have unifying moments where there's an act of aggression, and so we're all together on that, but then we kind of split off into our own camps and like, well, I like to do this and you do that and all this and that. But if you're there together and your common goal is self-preservation, like in the sense of being outdoors, you don't want to freeze to death or you don't want to fall on the ground and injure yourself, you have to work with other humans. And that lesson that we get from the outdoor pursuits is a paradigm shift that is healthy for our planet. And I'm an advocate for that. And like, climbing is great, but it's a vehicle for a philosophical transition in how we treat other humans.
But as we reach the end of my script here, we are in Oslo now.
Yeah.
And it's March. The winter is starting to turn into spring. And as you say, Oslo is not the worst place to be on a sunny day like this. But if you could choose somewhere else in the world to be right now, where would that be?
Right now on March 8th, or could I be any time in history?
Where's that? That's up to you.
Okay. So I live in the present. So today is the best day of my life, and tomorrow is going to be that best day. I try not to think back when I was in my 30s and I was stronger and I climbed like that, because I'm just going to let myself down. So what I aspire today is to live today as the best possible day. So I'm completely happy with where I am and what I'm doing. That being said, I could imagine spending the day sitting in the canopy of a rainforest and just observing and listening to the insects, the birds, the animals, the primates, and just, I mean, it's so unknown to me because I've spent my life in cold, frozen, very desolate, harsh environments. But to be in some place where there's so much flora and fauna would be, that's where I'd be.
Okay. But I also want one thing. When you come down from a big mountain and you get the first cup of coffee in base camp, what's it like?
Oh, you're always happy that you've made it back down, but you also appreciate the simple things. And so Rick Ridgway, who is a mentor and a dear friend, recently published a book, Life Lived Wild. And whenever we get together, we sort of like this glass of water, you and I will probably, it came from the faucet, it's there. We have it so we can talk. But if you've been on expedition and you have to find the snow, prep the stove, heat the stove up, run the stove, melt it, you realize how precious water is. And so when you share that moment again, you really appreciate the small items in life.
Thank you very much, Konrad Anker, and thank you very much for coming to the podcast.
Oh, Randolph, thank you for inviting me, and thank you, listeners in Norway, for... I wish I could speak fluent Norwegian, but I do appreciate your understanding of English, and stay in touch. Be good, be kind, be happy.
Thank you.
Take care.
Then I say goodbye to my English-speaking listeners and switch back to Norwegian. Jeg håper dere likte møtet med Konrad Anker. Jeg tar som nevnt gjerne tilbakemeldinger på hva dere tenker om å ha sporadiske besøk av engelskspråklige gjester i podcasten Uteliv. Avslutningsvis vil jeg gjerne takke alle som med i det digitale turlaget på Patreon og derigjennom støtteproduksjonen av podcasten Uteliv. Ta gjerne en tur innom podcastenuteliv.no og se om det her med Patreon kan være noe for deg også. Patreoner får blant annet ekstra episoder, tilgang til artikler og bakgrunnsstoff og påvirkningsmuligheter på episodetema, gjester og spørsmål. Jeg nevner også at de som velger nivået ekspedisjonsmakker for sitt medlemskap får tilbud om helgepass til messa Camp Villmark, som går av stabelen på Lillestrøm 29. april til 1. mai. Der blir jeg også til stede, blant annet med en scene med 7 live podcaster i løpet av helga. Om en uke
så kommer uansett en helt ny episode av podcasten Uteliv, da I sin helhet på norsk. I mellomtida får dere benytte vårvinteren til tur. Og da gjenstår det bare å si ha det bra.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hei, jeg heter Nora Helligsen og daglig leder I Barents Outdoor. Det beste vi kan gjøre for planeten å redusere forbruket vårt og få mer ut av det utstyret vi allerede har. Men vi vet av erfaring at bruken av telt kan endre seg over tid. Det teltet du kjøpt for 2 år siden passer kanskje ikke det behovet du har I dag. Derfor har vi I Barents etablert en egen panteordning der vi tar imot brukte telt av god kvalitet I innbytte når du kjøper et nytt av oss. Prosessen enkel. På barentsoutdoor.no gir du oss informasjon om teltet du vil bytte inn. Basert på det får du et tilbud fra oss som gir deg rabatt på ditt neste Barents-produkt. Mer info og betingelser finner du på barentsoutdoor.no. Og husk at den første reparasjonen på produkter fra Barents alltid gratis.